it's when you go home at night and you think your life is a total disaster and you're on the floor and you're gasping for air. It's at that moment when you really start applying your mind and learn a real hard lesson.
Welcome to another edition of Expedition Business, where we talk to inspiring South African entrepreneurs about the highs and lows of their business journey and how on earth they manage to keep the flame of business adventure burning. Of course, facing your day with a smile is sometimes the toughest thing you have to do. My name is Christelle Rosli Venter, your host and the one privileged enough to be talking to Rael Levitt, author of It Takes a Tsunami. But before I introduce Rael to you, I would like to remind you to please subscribe, like, comment and share this podcast with as many of your friends and family as possible. Without your help, we cannot continue to share the amazing stories of our South African entrepreneurs. But back to why we are here today. Rael Levitt founded Innerspace in 2017 and owner and manager of Service Logistics Parks. The company began with one industrial park in Epic Cape Town, and under Rael's leadership, Innerspace grew its assets in South Africa and the UK to over 3 billion rand. He's also the founding shareholder of Lyft Airline, launched in December 2020. But before all of that, Rael was the golden boy of the auctioneering industry, which ended with an overwhelming media frenzy after allegations at the Quin Rock auction in December 2011. Rael, welcome to Expedition Business.
Yeah, thank you. Hi.
Wonderful. It is, as I said, an amazing privilege. We know you are extremely busy, so thank you so much. I have a confession to make. I absolutely love autobiographies, and one that solidly grabbed my attention is the one It Takes a Tsunami. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yeah, I did hear about it because I walked into an exclusive books one day, and then I suddenly saw it on the top 10 list for a very short period. But I have heard about it, yes.
So how does it feel to see your book at the top 10 list?
Well, I mean, Christelle, first of all, it's not on the top 10 list now because books have a pretty much a short shelf life, but Crystal, similar to you, I always have loved biographies and memoirs, and autobiographies particularly, because it's I always remember there was this great quote, and I followed this Robin Sharma, and he said, like, when you read a book about Gandhi, it's like sitting and having coffee with Gandhi. And so I've really, really got to enjoy memoirs, and I get so inspired by them, and I always sort of really like learn great lessons, and when you hear it directly from the person, and whether the story is great or the story is not great. I remember one of the first books I ever read was about the late Anton Rupert, and it totally inspired me what he did in his business. So I'd always actually wanted to write a memoir, but then I had a tsunami, both a literal one and a metaphorical one, in my life. And so in COVID, I decided to finally not only be a lover of autobiographies, but actually to write my own one. And I took inspiration from various other authors whose style I like. And, one of them was the Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, who started Nike. I always liked the way he wrote, and many others. You know, the founder, Howard Schultz of Starbucks. So when you read the text, you see it has a certain tone, but I've looked at other people's autobiography. But It was a really exciting project, and it was a game changer for me because it was more than just an autobiography. It was telling the story of what had happened in sort of both tsunamis, and the second one, which was the business of the commercial tsunami. A lot of people had never heard from me about the subject because I kept quiet for so many years. So yeah, it was a great exercise, and I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed doing I did the audio version, which is available on Audible, when I actually narrated myself. So it was great fun.
I believe it was a lot of fun when you did the audio version. When was that?
So the book came out in December of 2022. I mean, it's amazing how quickly time goes. I mean, we're almost halfway into 2024. So it came out in sort of late December. And then the audio, the recommendations, get the physical one out and then the audio one would follow. So that December, sort of over Christmas and then last year, it came out. It was a hell of a thing. And today there's like AI, apparently. I haven't seen it actually. There's AI where you can read a section and it can read the whole book for you. But I did like the langdradig version, sitting in a booth in the middle of like Christmas holidays and going in every day and talking through. And I thought I could talk, probably, I mean, you do it as well, but reading a book takes a very long time. And then I did the whole thing. And then I went back and I listened to it and I sounded so boring. And I was like, no ways. So in fact, I'd never been an audio listener, but I became an audio listener. And the one book which I don't know if I like the content, it was Prince Harry's book called Spare. I like the way, because you know the British accent. So I then redid it to sound more like enthusiastic. But it came out last year in March.
But it is quite daunting listening back to your audio. And I suppose you've been an auctioneer for a very long time, where the bulk of what you do is talking. But it's a different type of talking.
It was certainly because it was a monologue. I mean, that's what it is. I wasn't talking to somebody, but sort of hearing my voice. I'd always heard my voice amplified in speakers and things like that. So a lot of people go, "Oh, that doesn't sound like me," but that part wasn't. But it was just the length of it.
I can imagine. But Raoul, would you recommend other entrepreneurs to write their memoirs as well?
So I've always found it an interesting thing in South Africa that not that many business people write memoirs. And you know, if you look at the United States, it's very common for people to write autobiographies and memoirs. And in South Africa, it's like, you know, if you walk into Exclusive Books, you don't see the story of Adrian Gore or Stephen Kosseff. And I think that those people have huge lessons to impart. And, you know, that may well be a South African thing with tall poppy and they don't want to be noticed. But entrepreneurs, whether you are a senior leader or you really just have like a story to tell, which I did, I think it is such a great lesson and something to leave behind. And, you know, interesting, the other day I was at friends of mine and they had the story of the founder of Bashini in South Africa, which has been an international success story. And he had also started Lewis Furnishes, so there's a double property. And what he had done was quite interesting. He had written his autobiography, but only for his family and friends. And I thought that was also actually quite an awesome thing to do. And today it's not that difficult to publish. So you can self-publish. You don't even actually have to do a physical book if you want to. So I would highly recommend that entrepreneurs do that and tell their story and let other people learn. And of course, their family and generations to come. Once it's done, it's done. And it's recorded. And, you know, we don't want to only leave Facebook as our sort of message to the world or our Instagram shots.
Yes.
So I do think it's a great thing to do.
But I think, unlike Facebook and Instagram, physically writing your memoirs forces you to go and dig deep into your thoughts and your whole why you are in business, why you are on earth.
I mean, truth be told, I mean, my autobiography really does tell a story of a rise and a fall and good times and bad times and recovery. And I must be honest with you, even the other day, I was having like a real like cuck day. And I was like, you know, it's like, we all have those days. And then I was like sitting at home thinking, oh, it's a terrible day. And, you know, do you want to be here? And what are we doing? I'd rather be on an island and becoming a surfer instead of like dealing with people and systems and environments. And I actually even found myself looking at my own memoir again, to remind myself, actually, you know, what did you do in that situation? It was like strange sort of being out of your own experience and going, actually, you know what I'm facing today isn't as bad as what I had faced 10 years ago or in my past. It's just another day.
Absolutely. But just getting back to your memoir, as far as I know, you've sold close to just over 20,000 copies at this point in time. Do you think that it would have been so insanely popular if you didn't experience the drama and all the media frenzy and everything that has happened at Quinn Rock on the 10th of December 2011?
Yes. So, I mean, So first is 20,000 in total. That was including audio and on Amazon. And funnily enough, I picked up an audience, which I never thought I would, people who like attending auctions in the UK. So I suddenly started noticing that on Amazon and Audible, who were selling in there and in the States, actually. So, but the majority was Africa. I mean, the truth is the story had like a bit of a scandal element to it. So the answer is, when I wrote the book, one of the publishers asked me, tell me, why are you doing this for starters? And who's your audience? So, I had to actually think of a long about it. So I said, okay, my audience is basically going to be, let's call it three audiences. The first audience are really those who want to know what happened, because it was a great media story. And it's a long time ago now, 2011, but it was a great media story. And there are a lot of people who are around the time and say, you know what, I want to hear about this because, I've seen other versions of it. And so there was that element to it. And I certainly think that drove like a lot of sales. Then there were 2011 is a long time ago. So, obviously you're too young to remember 2011, but to me, it felt like yesterday.
And, oh, you're such a trauma.
but the fact is that, you've got a whole range of young entrepreneurs today. If you are 25 years old today, 2011 was, it's 12 years ago, they were in high school. And even if they're 30 today, they were, they're still in high school. So to hear the story, but they were more interested in the entrepreneurism and realizing actually, life does have a series of like ups and downs and waves and good times and bad times. And I started very young in business. I wanted that market to read it as well. And then, my third market was people who had that I've worked with over the years, run big businesses and to show them an interesting story. And, it's quite interesting. I was in the States last year and I went to a conference and I took my book with them. I love the Americans. They go, it's so great because a book is like a big business card. And it is actually. So, I was recently trying to put together a deal in Europe. And I took somebody wanted to know about me. So I was like, here's the book and you can read the whole story. It's a very long CV, which you can read. So those are the three sort of markets that I looked at. But to answer your question, yes. The drama of what happened at Quinrock in 2011, there were a lot of people wanted to read that story. And that was the part I had to be the most careful about. Because firstly, I didn't want my whole life to come down to that event. And I think that what happens to a lot of people is that whether it's good events or bad events, often we bring our lives into like one moment. But yet there were many moments in the journey. And so I didn't want, and in fact, even in the book, I only get to the Quinrock part sort of two-thirds in. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, I just want to quickly page through and get to like Basti Skandal and Skinner. But that certainly fueled it. But to me, there was like an interesting story, which I wanted to tell as well, which was, trying to be neutral about it. I think it is an interesting story.
You mention in the book and in a lot of interviews recently, you've mentioned that one of the big takeaways that you get from everything that has happened at Quinrock, or not at Quinrock, but after Quinrock, has taught you so many valuable lessons in life, and that you wouldn't be where you are if you didn't get to learn those lessons. Do you think it's possible to somehow avoid the drama, to learn the lessons without having to go through all the massive dramas?
Well, at the end of the day, one person's drama is another person's day at the office or the day at the beach. So how we perceive drama is always different. And I'm conscious of that because at the end of the day, if you think about it, for example, people are going to deal with things in their lives. And it is, unfortunately, life, we always think our lives are going to be as we planned and in our career, and we write it all out and it's going to be that way. But, things happen. And so, we do have drama. So like COVID was a drama, which all of us experienced. Who saw that coming? And unfortunately, we're going to have people who are around us are going to have accidents and going to pass away and things are going to happen. And life is going to be a series of dramas. So for me, and again, determine what you call a drama, but the fact is that, some people do have very easy, smooth sailing lives and nothing dramatic happens. That's great. To me, you're lucky if that has happened. But I think one thing I've always believed in, and certainly it came out in the book and it emphasized that what happened to me is that the negative things that happen to you are are actually become your greatest lessons. And often I think when things go well and you know, we're high-fiving and we are successful, we don't really learn. It's when you go home at night and you think your life is a total disaster and you're on the floor and you're gasping for air. It is at that moment when you really start applying your mind and learn real hard lessons. And so, you know, and one of the books I listened to recently was The Obstacle is the Way. So often, you know, and that's my story, is that it's the difficult times actually bring out actually the best in people, which is great for a South African audience because, you know, my God, I mean, we live in a country where, like, it's always going to be drama. We just need to open up a news app and see it. So, but the fact is that that does create something. And, you know, it can bring out the worst in people, but generally it brings out the best in people. So I do believe that actually when we see bad things happen, we call it drama, what we can do is, when no one wants those times, but certainly to accept those and say, okay, what is the lesson in this?
Just want to quickly stand still at Quinrock before we move away, because there's so much more in your life than just Quinrock. But at the time when everything broke, you were the golden boy of the auctioneering industry. You've revolutionized the industry with, I think, 300 people that you employed, and with a turnover of around 5 billion rand. When you see everything literally vanishing before your eyes, do you not feel a point where you just want to stand at the top of a building 20 floors high and just fall down?
Yes. So the answer is yes. I went through those sort of dark moments where I literally, to me, anyone, you know, you or me or most people, I mean, where we see hope, we see light. So if we see that there's a way that things will come up, then we see. But there was a time where I couldn't believe, I was so exasperated and I couldn't believe it, and I couldn't see the light. And, you know, and many people get into a state of depression with that. I then went, and I actually went on medication because I didn't really want to go to the top of the building and jump off. But I mean, it is not something that I didn't contemplate. And I went through very dark moments and not seeing actually where the light could be. And then I decided, which I write about in the book, I decided after a while, okay, the only one thing I can't change then what has happened. I certainly can't change. Do I have regrets on my behavior and what happened? Absolutely. Do I? But I, you know, I have a sister who's a psychologist. I come from a family of therapists. My sister always reminds me, she says, look, you know, you can go back into the past and wonder, and your mind can ruminate, which is what I used to do. I used to ruminate and say, I did this wrong, and I did this wrong, and I did this wrong, and I did this wrong. And then I also did the other form of rumination, was this person did something wrong to me, and that person did something wrong to me. And I thought, and that's worse, by the way, because now you're blaming other people. And then one day I literally, I sat and I just said, okay, hold on a second. The only way I'm going to reframe this and not want to go to the top of the building is to actually come up with a plan. And the plan may be so, like, out there. I mean, because, I mean, you know, sort of after Quinrock, and you know, if your listeners don't know, but what had happened at Quinrock was, in essence, my reputation had been destroyed and the company I voluntarily closed. So what happened was that I sort of lost the business, but I also lost my identity, because I'd been doing it for so long, from when I was 20 years. And for me, it was those two things added to the fact that it just went on for years and years, the negative media. So I would have never have believed in my wildest dreams at that point that I would be the CEO of a company, which today, just at Innerspace, it's a 3 billion rand company, that would have been possible. And by the way, when I ask people like that, even they say, are you crazy? And even my good friends and my cousins are like, you know, don't worry about ever going back into business. Like, go sit on a beach and go chill out and go and run around the coffee shops of Cape Town and be like, you know, be a consultant, but don't go back into business. That would be stupid. So the fact is that I certainly came up with a plan, and I'm a huge believer in achieving goals. And it took a long time. I don't want to make up that this was like a quick story. It took years actually for me to sort of get back on my feet and develop the courage to go out and talk about it, or just to like act.
Well, I think it's a reality with, I think, almost every entrepreneur out there. There do come a time when things do seem very dark and you don't see light, and but people tend not to talk about it. They only talk about the nice things and all the successes.
Correct. I mean, it's funny enough, again, it's the one thing that the Americans always love talking about. It's like, the story of the sort of the rise and fall and rise again. And I don't, I'm sitting on a political conversation, but the thing that I always thought, like Donald Trump was doing it, because he's always like, about to be bankrupt, and then he was out, and then he's back in. And I think that like, it's much more an American thing where they actually sort of like people who've had failure. And if you look at many of the stories of like people who have had failure, and they absorb it. In South Africa, we tend to be a bit more like sort of English in culture. It's like, oh no, don't talk about the bad stuff. It's only talk about the successes. But I mean, the truth is that the greatest successes come from the people who had great failures. I mean, it's like, now I love many people do the Steve Jobs story where he gets thrown out of his own business. And South Africa had, the same PSG, Yanni Vitton wrote a book called, and then they fired me. So, and there are many in South Africa, Raymond Ackerman, the late Raymond Ackerman, the things of Pick and Pay today, but Raymond Ackerman was working at Checkers where he was fired and he had to start a business. So the truth is there are many, many examples where actually those difficulties do produce great and stunning results.
Mm-hmm. And I think the big message is it doesn't have to end up like a Marcus Joester to take his life.
Yeah. Yeah, of course it doesn't. And it was, by the way, that story of Marcus was always like, I didn't know Marcus Joester from a bar of soap. So I never met him, despite being in Stellenbosch on the day of that auction. But I didn't know. But it's a sad story, actually, that it ended that way. Because it's sad. And pensioners and people lost money, and the allegations of fraud, whether they're hyperbolic or not. But there is a sad story. But there's also a story there of, a person who did do like miraculous things and maybe got lost along the road. And I'm not certainly not trying to cover for Marcus Joester or negate anything he may or may not have done. But the fact is that it doesn't necessarily only have to end up that way. And also what happens, people also think in terms of age, because it's so funny, when you talk to 30-year-olds, they all think, well, if I don't sort out my career by the time I'm 40, I'm like done. I often hear that. Or if the people in their 40s, I've only got 10 more years, because by the time I'm 50, I'm going to be like an otis. And then people in their 50s go, but the fact is there's so many, there really are great stories. One of my greatest memoirs, coming back to that, was actually a movie called The Founder. The founder of, not the McDonald's brothers, but he had founded the McDonald's chain. He really only discovered McDonald's when he was in his mid-50s. And so the fact is it doesn't, that people have many opportunities. And of course, we live in a world today, if you're 80, you can become a president. So it's like there's plenty of time for people to come back and reinvent themselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just quickly, what makes you still get up in the morning? What motivates you with InnoSpace that is, as far as I know, now 5 times bigger than what Auction Alliance was? What motivates you to get up and keep on working, keep on developing?
Well, probably the fear of boredom probably motivates you. But, aside from that, I'm joking. But the fact is that I'm a great, and I spoke about it now, I'm a great, founder. I like starting new things. I like being disruptive and innovative. And in many ways, I often think a lot of entrepreneurs are actually frustrated artists because you're creating something. And so I'm using art as a sort of very general term. I don't mean the creative, but to me, it's like that something that starts in your mind, that starts the conversation in your mind, is that you can create. And so for me, that's what drives. And when I'm having like a bad day, it's like, let's just get out there and carry on and create the ultimate outcome. I mean, I think I am quite positive by nature. So I always believe in there's going to be a happy outcome. And that does drive me. And it's like adding value. So, at the end of the day, if you get deeply philosophical, to me, business is the ability. And that's why I use that sort of concept of art of creating. But as an entrepreneur, you can create disruptive things that can positively affect a small group of people or a large group of people, or it can positively impact an industry. And with that comes a responsibility. And so, there are days, even this week, it's like, this thing happened and that thing happened, and I was upset we lost a transaction. And, you know, in one of the businesses I'm involved in, it hasn't gone that well. And then I go, but you know what? You actually have a responsibility to the people around you, but to yourself, to just like, at the end of the day, saying, you know, the only thing I can do is just go curl up into a little ball and fight another day. And so I sort of that drives me just to get up and to do it, and to see that there is a successful and happy outcome.
And in terms of challenges, you've learned so many lessons in all the years that you've been in business, which is, I think, now about 30 years that
That's
you've
right.
been in business.
Yeah.
So do you still have moments where you've got challenges that you think is way too much for you, way too big, you just, again, want to curl up?
Yes, I mean, a friend of mine said to me the other day, it's like, why do you do that to yourself? It's like, why don't you just why don't you just like chill out? And, because him and his wife went to overseas recently and they took like a bit of a sabbatical and they're going like, and I like looked at them, that is really awesome to do. And, I think it is something that I would like to do. So the question of sort of like the drive and constantly trying to do something. Yeah, I do think it's something that you can look at and say, you know, why are you constantly, why am I constantly doing that? And for me, as long as like I'm enjoying it and I like it, I do that drive. In terms of the lessons that I've learned over the period, and of course, like I certainly don't want to say that everybody has lessons, and enormous lessons. Often we think our lessons aren't as exciting as the lesson of somebody who's more well known, but the fact that there's so many huge lessons that we learn, and you know, the irony is that, and I remember when I between InnerSpace and Auction Alliance, I had like quite a long period of doing not much, and I personally didn't like it. It just didn't. I used to wake up in the morning and I felt that I had no like purpose now, and I tried various things. I tried to get involved in like a charity. I sat on a board and I don't want to say that I'm like everybody, because people do find enormous purpose in raising families and doing various other endeavors and enjoying themselves. But for me, like I could only sit at so many beaches, and I could only have coffee in so many coffee shops, and I could only spend so much time with my family. I needed some form of purpose, and but business does give me that. It doesn't, you know, that other things could be doing as well. But the irony was I went to go and study, and I went back to university, which was really weird. I've been a CEO since I was 20. I was in my early 40s, and I went back with like a backpack on my shoulder, and I went and I became a student. And so I did an MBA. MBA. So I wasn't around 18-year-olds in California, and I went to study in Singapore. But when I was there, I would keep this like book next to me in all these like lectures, and I'd go, these are the mistakes I've made, and these are the lessons I've learned, and this is what I will not repeat. But what happens is, and somebody warned me, they said that the irony is you probably won't repeat the mistakes that you made in the past, but you're just going to make new ones that you haven't thought of yet. And of course, that is what has happened. So you can't, and we all have to watch ourselves, because we get into repeat behavior. But the lessons are constant, and I still to this day like to keep a little journal, and I write down, you know, what are the lessons, and what did I get wrong, and what did I get right, and the mistakes. And I'm like, And again, because I've come from this concept of like the negative things which happen to us can be the positive things, I sort of beat myself up on when I make mistakes, and we went wrong here and we didn't go right there. And I like to do that, not because I'm a depressive and need to be on medication. It's the fact that I say like that's where in the lessons lie.
Just a quick question. Speaking of studying at the age that you did, do you think you got more value from your studies than when you would have done it in your 20s, before you had all the physical experience?
I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, when I was at UCT in my early 20s, I was rocked up on campus when I was 19. I mean, I knew like nothing of nothing. And so, in fact, all I really wanted to do while I was at university then was just get out of university. So, I mean, there's no question about it, that adult education, and again, when you're doing something that you want to do. So, you know, often when you're 18 or you're not quite sure what you want to do, and somebody tells you to do this, and, you know, in my era, it was a little less choices. Today, there's more choices, but there was a little less choices. So, I mean, studying as an adult is just completely different. And in fact, I actually did much better. I mean, I couldn't have to come rushing up to my parents to say I had good marks or good grades, but I didn't have that impetus. Or my father said, I'm not paying for your university fees because you're messing around. But the fact is that as an adult, you learn much more. I mean, you come in with so much more experience. I really do think adult education is such a great thing. And I think people should be carrying on studying and studying, whether it's formally or informally, constantly.
Absolutely, absolutely. I can just, while you're talking, I'm thinking about my three children that's at university at the moment. I should tell them they should stop studying.
You go to campus tomorrow morning instead of go online, wherever they're doing it, instead of them.
Absolutely. Well, what would be your fun and exciting ways to relax and rejuvenate your soul?
So, I suppose probably not to disturb too many people. I mean, the first thing what I like to do is, which I never did in my early years, was exercise. So I think exercise is like such a great thing. And even in that book, I talk about running, because I've never run until I was the age of, I thought I couldn't run, because, you know, we all tell ourselves stories. I was like, no, you know, I'm a fat little boy from Cape Town and I can't actually really run. And then I suddenly one day I just found myself running and I ended up doing a marathon. So actually, there is a bit of a theme in the book about how running became an important thing for me to do, including doing marathons, actually. So exercise for me is great, because it's not only can it be fun, but also I think it's very good for your serotonin. And I literally try to go, this morning I was in the gym at 6 o'clock, and yesterday and the day before, so I do find that fun. In terms of switching off completely, I do like to read, and I find that when I'm very busy at work, I don't know, many people are like this, but I find that actually I can't actually fully concentrate when I'm doing that. So I like to go I like to travel a lot. So some of it's for business, but I like to just sit on a beach and really like chill out. I do like being in nature like many people. I lead quite an active social life. I like hanging out with friends and family and with my family. And I like more than anything hanging out with my dog, because she listens to all my stories and always seems to like me for the answer, no matter what it is. And so those are the things that I enjoy doing.
Said hanging out with your family, what would you guys do?
Well, I mean, we're quite a close family, so we get together quite often and we have a lot of like family meals and we do things together and we actually travel together, and that would also be, you know, extended family. And so, you know, those are the things which we like to do, and it's like keeping in touch with family is important. So we, even I have a sister lives in America and her family, and so we try and see to that we get together. We actually haven't actually got together for a while. I'm talking about her kids, but but just to see that we get together, because I think those things are important and they're grounding.
Mm-hmm. And to keep you sane. But I want to get back to your running. What is your big marathons that you have taken part in? What do you still want to do?
Yeah, so I mean, there's an interesting story about the marathon. So what had happened is I started sort of running in my 50s. I don't run 10Ks here. Up to 10Ks there. And I like running on a treadmill at the gym. And then what had actually happened is, in the midst of the Auction Alliance sort of like scandal and disaster, what had happened was I really went very pear-shaped at one stage. And I really like thought, oh, this, you know, am I going to be like the treated like the great, you know, the great criminals? Am I going to be, this was before Marcus used to start, but I was, so what happened, I went to go see an advocate in Cape Town, and he was like, look, you know, this whole story's been overblown and it's over-exaggerated. And he said, so, because I'd actually brought a court application at that stage. He was quite an eccentric advocate. He said to me, what do you like to do? So I said, well, you know, I like to auction. He said, oh, well, we're not going to do that. And he thought that was quite funny. He said, what else? I said, well, you know, like, I like running. He said, oh, I've got the answer. To keep your mind off all of this, go run a marathon. I was like, are you mad? I can only run 10Ks. Like, a marathon is 42Ks. And so he said, well, what are the big marathons of the world? So I said, well, I don't know. I've never looked at his house. I've heard of the New York Marathon. And so he said, okay, that's it. That's your strategy. Go run the New York Marathon. And so I actually decided to do that. It became one of my goals, actually, was to go run the New York Marathon, which I did, which was probably the greatest, one of the great moments of my life, to do that New York Marathon. And it was so great. And it became very emotional for me. I mean, I think I cried the last 10 kilometers, maybe half out of pain and half out of that I actually was achieving something. But for me, it was more than just a physical achievement. It was the fact that actually I had sort of like overcome all the issues. And it was actually at that moment when I, not long after, I started Innerspace. Because then I did that. I later did the London Marathon as well, which I enjoyed. And then I got into this thing of doing, you know, they call it the Big Five marathons around the world. So yes. And I've done lots of half marathons here in South Africa. I've done twice the Jerusalem Marathon, which is very hilly. But the ones I'd like to do is still Berlin and Tokyo and Chicago. Those are the sort of three I'd like to get to.
And do you ever get to do trail running? You stay in Cape Town with all those amazing trails.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I don't really, because for some reason I prefer. I mean, I live on the beachfront, and I mean, Cape Town's quite amazing, because if you get in like a pocket on the Atlantic seaboard, you can literally run 20Ks without crossing a road. So I sort of live there, and I probably more hike in the mountains. I don't really do trail running. I always think I'm a bit unfit, and I like. Because it's much more difficult, right, than road. I don't know. So I haven't really done trail, but I probably should, actually. So maybe I'm going to write it down on my goal list to do some trail.
There's the most amazing, amazing trails around you. And, yeah, you can literally just where you live, just go up. And everywhere, as you know, there's entrances to start the trails. And, yeah, maybe you can tackle UTCT one of these days.
Yeah, maybe.
That would be really, really cool to see you there. So, Raul, if you could be 20 years old again, and I'm sure you've had this question many, many, many times. You started working, you were the CEO already of your first company at 20. But if you could be 20 years old again, what would you change?
Probably everything. But the fact is that And again, you know, as we go through life, we're going to answer that question at different times. Most people, when they start getting into like, I'm not quite there yet, but they close their 60s, so, you know, what I'd do is 20, I would realize that life is short and have more fun. But I didn't, and I don't regret it. So at 20, I was like working, and everybody was having fun. I was working hard. So I probably think one of the things I would like do differently or relook at is like, I'd probably analyze a little bit more and act a bit less, because, you know, I'm very action oriented. So I just go out and I do things. I think it's got an advantage. But sometimes you do need to sit back and think and analyze. I probably would have found mentors a bit younger, because it was only actually in my late 30s where I really started understanding the power of having somebody who could mentor me, and somebody who I respected and I enjoyed. So I'd certainly be looking out for those sort of mentors before. I mean, I would also, when I was in my 20s, And I was always very worried what people would think of me, because I wasn't, and again, that did drive me to an extent, but I think that those things suck up so much energy. And in the end, actually, it's probably one of the great lessons in auction lines. So, like, you know, don't be that concerned, because actually people don't really care about you, they don't really care about what's going on in their environment. So I'd certainly, you know, that would be a great lesson for me. And then it would to be... Just again to sit back and think, you know, what if I'm doing, is it right? Is there a better way? Should I be doing something completely differently? And to be more introspective than just like go with doing things blindly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So quite a lot of things that you would want to change. What would you keep the same?
Well, I think that like curiosity, I've always been like very curious, and I would certainly keep that curiosity. I think today it's actually easier to be curious, because there's so many channels that you can have. I mean, you could just literally spend your day on your TikTok or Instagram or Facebook account and learn about new things. So I've always been like, that I wouldn't change about like learning, because I like it. And again, learning doesn't have to be formal. Learning is literally every day. In fact, I'm about, just because shortly I'm doing like an internal, we call it a town hall, and in the space, and there's a book I was reading called it's a book about CEOs. I've got it on my desk, you know. It's just recently come out. I've been reading this book, The Diary of the CEO, and I was like, and I'm like learning, and I'm going, wow, I love this. I'm cutting out snippets, and I wanted to share it with people. So constantly that curiosity, I think I wouldn't like to stop, and I think that's an important thing. And that sort of you know, that sort of positive. You know, more is not a dag, wake up and go and fight out there. I would keep that for sure.
Wow, that is so positive to hear. You've mentioned books that you read before and that you're still reading. What would be, and I know it's very, very, very difficult, but your number one book that you can recommend to entrepreneurs out there?
So, I mean, the one book which really had an impact on me many, many years ago, and it helped me actually in the actual business, was the book by Jim Collins called Good to Great. Now, and I still refer to it. And in fact, in our own company, I gave it to my COO to read. Because, you know, he's 32, but did come out a few years ago. There's been subsequent books by Jim Collins. But Good to Great basically is a great guide to how to run a business. And I really love that book. I'm even sit there on my bookshelf behind it, probably is there to this day. And I often even reread it. And it's really what, you know, and he starts off basically saying that, like, good is the enemy of great, and goes through, like, a very practical way of how to run a business. So it was a huge impact to me, that Good to Great book.
Okay. I see there's a couple of copies of your book, It Takes a Tsunami, on the bookshelf. Yes.
Well, those are the ones that weren't sold at exclusive when we got off the bestseller list.
Okay. And your number one quote to inspire entrepreneurs?
Oh, I've got so many. I mean, I love quotes, and but often my quotes are most really about sort of like about tenacity and about sort of like, you know, tenacity is a breakfast of champions. You know, it's those sort of quotes which I like, and I mean, I really do love. I love the all the different quotes, and I mean, you know, one which personally resonated with me was like Steve Jobs' quote. I may not get it right, but the one quote was like, you know, and he spoke about it in the context of when he fails at Apple and they fire him. And he says, you know, the one thing is that when I failed and I sort of fell out of being a CEO, it gave me the freedom to be a startup again. It gave me the freedom to be like new again. And I always love that quote because it basically is saying that when bad things happen, it's like it actually takes off the shackles of all your past experiences and it gives you the ability to be a beginner again. And I really do love that quote, and it resonates with me.
It almost reminds me of the saying that each day is a new day.
Yeah, and absolutely.
The reality is...
I mean, South Africans and Afrikaans, it's always like more, that's not a dag. At the end of the day, it's in Afrikaans, it means tomorrow is another day. So
yes.
The fact is that, you know, and then I have like, in fact, even at, we used to have it at work on the fridge, it's like... you know, I have to have the strength to know that today may be tough, difficult, but the real power is to know that I can start afresh again tomorrow morning.
And I think also the reality that everyone stuffs up at some point in time. Nobody gets it perfect, ever.
And if they don't, they can create an Instagram story and it looks like they got it perfect. So we've always got social media to pretend that life is just absolutely fantastic.
Life is not perfect at all. And I think that's probably also why I love reading about other people that's had mishaps, because it just makes me feel so much better. It's okay to make a mistake here or there.
I mean, look, if you're an entrepreneur particularly, you're making many, many decisions. And the fact is, if you're getting 100 decisions, I mean, like literally you're getting 50% of your decisions right, you're lucky. But if you're an entrepreneur and making 100 decisions, I mean, you're going to get things wrong. And in fact, and you should be getting things wrong. And so, like, yes, you are going to get things wrong and you are going to make mistakes. Not everything is going to be perfect.
Absolutely. So, Rael, your metaphorical mountains, if you do get your trail shoes on metaphorically and you go for those massive mountains, which summits do you still want to reach within the next 3 to 5 years?
So for me, I mean, there are a couple. I mean, the one is something which I've never got right, and I'm really trying again at the moment, and that's just to get, like, I really want to create a technology business, and we have started one actually. So I just, because I think that does require different skill sets to get tech right. I'm a huge because I like innovation. I think technology is such an amazing thing, and the AI that's coming out now. But to create a business around that would be a huge summit for me to achieve. And then, like, it is so, and this, you know, could go along with that, but the other summit for me is to be able to do something outside of South Africa. Now, you know, many people are like, oh, I have to go to South Africa because of the countries listed. But for me, it's like, in many ways, for me, I have, like, achieved in the South African context of building something exciting. And I always ask myself the question, would it be possible for me to do that somewhere else? So that's a huge summit for me to achieve. You know, maybe the technology does it somewhere else, because technology is a bit borderless, but it is, can be borderless. So those are two things which I'd really like to be able to tick the box on, and say, wow, I got this one right. And then we can go back and sit on the beach and drink pina coladas.
Any specific technology that you are looking at?
Well, I mean, what we did is in the space, we'd actually built property technology. Now, I've been in property. In fact, I've been in property my entire life. The auction business was in real estate. So it is in prop tech, what they call prop tech. And I think it is a rapidly expanding space, because we all need, we're going to be in some sort of physical environment, as in a building. I mean, you know, we don't necessarily need to buy our running shoes or trail running shoes today. We need to go to a shopping center, but it would certainly go through a warehouse. So real estate is a critical part of life, unless one day there's a pull where we can just, you know, sleep standing up in a public square. But the fact is, technology in real estate is something which I really am focused on, and something which I enjoy, and something which I believe is actually going to be growing.
If we can just summarize your biggest lessons that you can give budding entrepreneurs to go forward.
Yeah, and I think, listen, we've spoken a lot about it, but the you know, I mean, there's several lessons, but the first one is, I mean, I've got so many lessons, I don't know where we start, but, you know, the first one is, as an entrepreneur, is that you do need to try again, and failure is the lesson, which we've spoken about at length now, but it's certainly not the end. In fact, it often is just the beginning. And failure doesn't mean the entire business fails. It just means you failed in a project, or you failed in something that you did. But it's certainly to have the tenacity to continue. So that's the first thing. The second one, and I'm sort of listing them in my mind, but the second one is to surround yourself with the right people. I think that's absolutely critical. And by the way, you are going to tell your kids at university the same thing, but you are right. And again, in business. So if you're around people who are inspirational, then you become inspirational. So do surround yourself with the right people, and, you know, make those sort of, like, those difficult calls internally when you are there. I think another great lesson is to map things out and to really plan with the end goal in mind, whatever that end goal may be, and that may change, but to really actually create to create a goal of where you want to be, to create a strategy, and then to spend a lot more time on your strategy than what you think you need to. So, because often we develop a business strategy, we convince ourselves of the strategy, we fall in love with our own strategy, and we don't bounce it off the right people. So getting a mentor would also be a great lesson for people. And again, a mentor, you know, people say, oh, my mentor has to be, you know, Steve Jobs, or it has to be Elon Musk, but it doesn't have to be. There are many people you can take them, even business advice from, aren't business people, just because they're practical. And so it's like, you know, finding those people to take that sort of practical advice from. And again, often being a leader can be quite lonely, because, you know, you're always expected to have the answers. So it's really to have that humility to say, actually, I don't always have the answers. And then, you know, and then to need to be authentic, and just to say, tell people, I don't have the answers, or I did mess up here. People like that, actually. It's been one of my great revelations. It's like, actually, when you always pretend that everything is fine, and you're living to that, like, Instagram world, where it's just, like, all perfect, and your abs are great, and you look beautiful because you spend 3 days trying to get the perfect photo, people actually don't like that, because they think that it's not genuine. What they do like is actually to know that we all have frailties, and we all mess up, and we all have insecurities, and we all go home at night thinking it's like we've had a terrible day. So to be authentic, and when you are authentic, like that, people are authentic back, and people actually in many ways want to assist and help you.
And it also, yeah, it reminds me of a whole neuro-linguistic programming concept, that if you admit that you've got mistakes, people relate to you so much better than if you try and emulate this perfect world.
Absolutely. And correct. And of course, yeah, I think you only learn that a little bit when you're older. When you're younger, you're just trying to create this sort of like, and again, I mean, the world we're living in now, which is very visual, very, very, oh, I mean, one dimensional, and in many ways not real, because it's, I mean, if you think about it, all these social media platforms that we all are hooked to, and you know, kids are, you know, they may be more TikTok than we may be more Facebook or Instagram, but all these things at the end of the day, that they are just marketing tools. And people realize that that's a marketing tool. And if you want to, first question is like, why are you marketing? Do you need to market yourself? Is that what you're doing? And secondly is, don't forget everybody else's marketing. So don't believe that everybody's lives are just so beautiful, because their marketing channel is good. All marketing is good. You never find anybody saying that, you know, a negative marketing is going to be positive marketing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One lesson that you've just reminded me of today is that age should be celebrated. The older you are, the wiser you are, and the more knowledge you have, the more people should look up to you, as opposed to a 50-year-old or a 40-year-old.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I like saying now I turn 50, so I can say that. I need to say that. But the fact is that, you know, the world also changed a bit because of technologies, because all the very successful business people at many, let's say, youngsters would aspire to were Mark Zuckerberg, who made a success at 25, and Elon Musk was, you know, flying higher at 30, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it wasn't always like that. In the old days, it was actually older people who'd been around. But I mean, there is nothing, you can't take away experience. I mean, and not like, you know, I have a brother's in technology. He was telling me the other day, he only likes to hire people, like, my brother's not this thing, he only wants to hire people straight at university. He doesn't even want, because he thinks that people who are already 25 are like actually like a little, getting a bit stale in the world of technology where he's from. Which that may be, by the way, the case in terms of like fresh ideas and about AI and things that, you know, that we didn't learn at that stage. But the fact is, nothing is better than actually having the experience of life and people and failure and success. And that experience has to be celebrated and has to be drawn upon. And so, and I often even say to, like, you know, to kids, go talk to your grandparents, because, you know, they're the ones who've got like a real life experience and know the ups and downs and you can learn.
Thank you for listening to Expedition Business, your number one source of the highs and lows of our South African entrepreneurs. Don't forget to subscribe, like, comment, and share this podcast with as many of your friends and family as possible. Without your help, we cannot continue to share the amazing stories of our South African entrepreneurs. And remember, you can find a lot more information on today's conversation and the rest of the Expedition Business episodes at www.expeditionbusiness.co.za.